Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be here and part of this really exciting symposium. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about a construct that we've tried to put together, myself and about 100 people around the country, really trying to think about ways to take all these exciting new concepts in drug targeting and biomarkers and try and figure out how we can turn that into a rapid change in what patients experience. Because after all, at the end of the day, all this is to improve the outcome for our patients. So we don't want all these exciting things to then take 10 to 20 years to get into the clinic. And when you look at the current pathway for drug development, it's actually quite sobering. It is said that it takes about 10 to 15 years, about 6,000 volunteers and $1 billion to get a drug to market. And I think increasingly, as the science is telling us how exciting it is that there is particular subsets are going to benefit from particular drugs, we can't. This is not a viable solution. All of breast cancer, in spite of it being a very common cancer, it will actually be. It's actually a number of cancers, and so every drug development effort will be an orphan drug development, and $1 billion will not encourage anybody to want to do. Drug development, I heard that the return on investment from oncology drugs is something like 0.3%. That's also somewhat sobering. So we really have to change the paradigm. And the other thing that's wrong is about 25 to 30% of phase 3 trials succeed. So clearly we're doing something wrong in the phase 2 setting. I think what we want to do is really learn from other industries. You know, technology certainly in science has proceeded at an incredibly rapid rate, and we want to emulate that. And I think one of the, I particularly like this very short article from Andy Grove, who's the founder and former CEO of Intel. And he wrote this really acerbic, short little thought piece in JAMA about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, called Efficiency in the Healthcare Industries. He didn't mean efficiency, of course, a view from the outside. And one of the things that, you know, many people think of this as product life cycle or what he calls it, a knowledge turn. And I think it's a really good framework for all of us to think about. And I think that we want to be smart and innovative and clever and think about how do we drive change. The biggest winners of rapid change will be our patients. But everyone else will gain too. The pharmaceutical industry, the biotech industry, academia, if we can figure out how to rapidly turn these ideas into action and make it affordable to figure out how to study these drugs and match the biomarkers. But it actually fits really with the paradigm they use in the semiconductor industry, because he thinks about a knowledge turn as the indicator from an experiment to proceed from hypothesis to result to new hypothesis to new result. That's the knowledge turn. In the semiconductor industry, that knowledge turn is 6 months. That's Moore's law, right? That's the number of resistors on a chip will double every 6 months and be shipped, you know, into the billions. So how do we get to that kind of an idea? So if you think about cancer, if we use this concept of metastatic disease, adjuvant, and practice, you're looking at a 20-year knowledge turn. You're committed to that long term. So we have to change that. And one of the things that can really accelerate change is thinking about the natural way to turn our processes around. Where can you integrate biomarkers testing along the course of treatment? Well, in breast cancer, and in fact, breast cancer is not even the best example. I would submit that lung cancer, GE junction tumors, esophageal tumors, pancreatic tumors, all of these tumors would be ideal for this setting. But I happen to be a breast cancer specialist, so that is where it's being done. So if you think about how we develop in the breast cancer world, we test new drugs, and everybody says, okay, the only time you can test a new agent is in the metastatic setting because that's the only ethical place. I hope that you'll all agree with me at the end of this that is not true. And so what happens is we introduce a drug. It takes us 2 to 4 years. And the more effective you are, the longer it takes. So the more effective drugs you have, the more first-line therapies you have, second-line therapies, you have to test and prove that you are equivalent to that. So that can take 2 to 4 years, now probably 6 years. And then, in order to prove it, you go into the classic ideas, the adjuvant setting. So we operate on patients, we take away the tumor along with all the biomarkers, and then we give people chemotherapy plus or minus a new agent, and you have to follow them up because disease-free survival is your endpoint, but because you're bringing thousands of patients, you're talking about 5 years to recruit and 5 years to follow up. So, you know, you're now into that 5 to 10 year knowledge turn. So again, you're stuck. But if you take advantage of the fact that we know that the order of therapy doesn't matter, and it works out pretty well because I'm a surgeon, and when I say to a patient, I can honestly tell you if you are at risk of your disease spreading, my operating on you is not going to help you. That is not going to be what makes a difference. So let's not start with that. Let's start with what makes the most sense, and let's naturally use this period of time to get the information from the biomarkers. So you do your systemic treatment plus or minus a new agent up front in the patients who are truly at high risk. You can't be indiscriminate. I'll show you why. Then you operate, and guess what? You've had your diagnostic biopsy, and now you have your tumor on the other end. Now you've got your natural pairs of biomarkers, and as you'll see in the I-SPY trial, you have many, many more pairs of biomarkers. But if you're going to learn and figure it out, and you're going to learn early, that's the only way to do it. And so you actually have the opportunity to have that one-year knowledge turn. That is a dramatic change, but there are a number of other things that have to go on too. So we really thought about I-SPY 2 as a way to design a trial that would have built into it the optimization of success of a phase 3 trial. So my co-PI is Don Barry. And Don, who is one of the leading biostatisticians in the country, he's currently at MD Anderson, but he is, you know, an evangelist for talking about how the process, the current process of trials is just not working. You know, you should not be having 15 of 18 drugs fail when they get to phase 3. You should know that before you move on to phase 3. So we have to do a better job. And I'm sure this is a place where we have startups. So what's the rule? Fail early and move on to the next great idea. That's we need to do a lot more of that. And I think the FDA has made it very clear they don't want drugs with small benefit. And I think that they will approve drugs with a big signal, and they'll do it in a lot more efficient way. But that's what we've got to look for. So we want to test the agents where they matter most. In the neoadjuvant setting, you want to identify poor prognosis cancers, and we'll talk about that a lot because I think, again, getting your denominator right is critical, and I think that's what's given neoadjuvant therapy a bad name. We have really worked on integrating the advocates into the trial process design because this has to work for patients. That's who it's for. And one of the reasons why I really like the neoadjuvant setting is because in spite of all the great things that we put into the clinic, we haven't cured anybody in the metastatic setting. We have delayed, you know, we can prolong survival. But when you take a drug like Herceptin, and it works to prolong survival in the metastatic setting, but in the adjuvant setting, it cures people. So if, by the way, one of these drugs works, you will probably save people's lives. I think that's a pretty compelling argument. So you also need to be able to figure out how you want to rapidly tailor your agents. So that's adaptive design. And you want to integrate your biomarkers up front, so you want to learn as you go. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And you want to graduate drugs with a predicted probability of success in phase 3 trials for a given biomarker profile. And we've set that at 85%. So we want the success rate to change dramatically. And the other thing is, for those of you who have been involved in trials, I'm sure you all know that we have put up with a lot of inefficiency. And I think we just say, well, that's the way it is, and so that's the way we'll continue. Well, that's just ridiculous, you know, so we can't do that. So we have to then think really hard about what are the things that drive inefficiency? How do we change them? How do we think about them? So in some ways, I-SPY 2 is an experiment to really try and think about how to drive the process in a very different way. So this combination of adaptive design, a master IND, so that, you know, every time you add a new drug, you don't write a new protocol, because in fact, you really don't need to. We want to test drugs by class across many companies. Really, this is a pre-competitive collaboration because the industry actually will benefit tremendously from learnings. Many companies have similar drugs in their pipeline. They can learn from one drug to figure out which drugs in their pipeline they want to proceed, if another company is ahead of them. It doesn't hurt. It actually, I think there's many, many examples of where pre-competitive collaboration works. And I think the, one of the reasons why the FDA has been so supportive of us is that we really are trying to drive this idea, and it's something that they would like to see. We'd like to see everyone not have to reinvent the wheel, because that's very expensive. We've separated any financial support from the drug supply. Whether we can figure out how to make this a sustainable model, that remains to be seen. But in the meantime, it will succeed for this particular trial, and I'll talk to you a little bit about the IT infrastructure, and we've been working with CA Big on that. And probably, I think one of the keys to our success has really been using a team approach, and there's no one person. I'm the facilitator. I don't own all the data. In fact, the more it can be shared, the better it is for everyone. And there's an opportunity for everyone to get credit and have responsibility and drive parts of the process throughout the trial. So I-SPY1, actually it is an acronym. It's my last acronym because I can't remember what most of my acronyms stand for anymore. But and it took me a long time to realize that this trial actually had the initials of 007 in it. It wasn't until the trial closed that I figured that out. Anyway, it was originally the CIA trial because it was CLGB, Interspor, and Akron. That's where the I-SPY came from. And it spent an evening in the back room of Matt Ellis's house figuring out how to come up with something here. So it is investigation of serial studies to predict your therapeutic response with imaging and molecular analysis. But we had to drop the CIA when the NCI, Center for Bioinformatics, came into the picture because we couldn't have CIA on the website. So this was actually a pretty simple construct. We just wanted to prove that a bunch of sites around the country, there are 9 sites that participated in this initially, could actually do serial core biopsies, serial MRIs, and actually agree on a single protocol, get data that you can share and compare. It was really an exercise in setting standards and creating an ethic of teamwork across sites, and to really try and miniaturize all these samples in a way that, you know, one person would run the assay, but everyone would have access to the data to be able to investigate their favorite idea. And the idea is, once it's done once, no one should have to repeat the study because this could serve as a baseline. And we looked at intermediate endpoints of clinical response, pathological complete response, residual cancer burden, and our long-term outcome was recurrence-free survival overall and overall survival at 3 years. And we actually started this in 2003 and had a number of platforms, and out of a single core, we actually had 2 paraffin cores and 2 frozen cores, but almost all of our data was generated from a single frozen core. And because no one got a core, we tried to figure out what we wanted to do, and we miniaturized everything and figured out how to share and be as efficient as possible. We were actually able to generate a lot of endpoints off of that information and showed that this worked. There's a couple of really interesting things that we found. So our requirement was people had to have tumors of 3 centimeters or greater. And I'm not going to talk about screening, but I would say that, just so you have this in context, out of a screened population, only 30% of your tumors, 33% at the most, are going to be high-risk tumors. So I would submit that the kinds of patients that show up with these big tumors have different biology. And these are the patients who are most at risk. So we have to understand that screening has increased the denominator of low-risk tumors. So you have to be careful not to bunch everybody together. So the trick about all this is to look by subsets. In fact, if you don't analyze by subsets, you're going to miss most of the insights. And I think all the biologists, I see them all shaking their heads. That's the way it goes. And so, but the trick is you have to prove that so that the FDA can also change the way they think about things. So 91% of these patients had a poor risk biology signature by the 70 gene prognosis profile. Our mean tumor size was big, it was 6 centimeters. You know, not surprisingly, this was a young group of patients. Most patients the majority were under the age of 50. Not even eligible for screening, I might add. So the patients in I-SPY1 are really the very patients who are most at risk. And again, because I said therapy saves lives in the adjuvant but not the metastatic setting, this is really where you can make the difference. We found that both pathologic complete response, and I'll show you a couple examples, and residual cancer burden are highly predictive of outcome, but they are stronger predictors when analyzed by subgroups. So that was our hypothesis, and that's why we say that this can be used as a trial endpoint for the evaluation of novel agents. So again, you have to get your denominator right. And we also showed in I-SPY 1 that MR volume change is a non-invasive way to predict pathologic complete response. And in fact, MRI is not particularly good at discriminating between either tumor scattered disease left or a little bit of disease left and all disease gone. But it turns out that biologically, the people who have essentially everything gone do just as well. So being able to look at RCB, the residual cancer burden of 0-1 versus not MRI is a very good discriminator of that. So I think eventually we will be able to develop MRI into a tool that allows us to move on even without surgery. As a surgeon, I can say that. So this is pathologic complete response, which, okay, this is clearly better. I mean, if this were a drug trial, people would be very excited about it. But so this is the patients who had pathologic complete response and no pathologic complete response at recurrence-free survival. But actually, if you look at the patients then who, if you then within that group start looking at the subsets, and I think one of the things that's really important is, I don't know, is this a pointer? Excellent. Okay. So one of the things that I said before is you want to, this is one of the things we've done in I-SPY 2, is we have taken in the group of patients that had their, that were profiled in I-SPY 1, if we eliminate the low-risk, the low-risk biology groups who are hormone receptor positive, none of these patients recurred, and none of them had a path CR. This is not the group that we want to be studying and looking at in terms of adding new agents, because we're not going to make any, there's going to be no signal here. But this group that's left has a really poor response. And if you look at residual cancer burden, this is near complete response, and this is complete response. This is actually a group of hormone receptor positive patients who recurred in spite of the PASCR. Then here's your intermediate group and your significant residual cancer burden. And I would submit that these people have a faster trajectory to recurrence and death than the average person walking in with metastatic disease, who's the focus of everyone feels comfortable saying, oh, that's okay, that we can give a test to all our new agents on. So I submit that this is the right place to be looking. And I think if you look again by subsets, the thing that you see, we don't see a huge response rate and again, they're very different response rates based on your tumor profile. And we found that the intrinsic subtypes do not perform better than hormone receptor and HER2 receptor, but that's okay because the intrinsic subtypes told us to look at these particular subsets. So we learned that, in fact, you have to look by subsets. But when you happen to have a complete pathologic response, you do great when you're hormone receptor positive. No recurrence. And that now already is, and I can tell you that our follow-up, these people are continuing to recur. So over time, because the hormone receptor positive group has delayed recurrences, you're going to start to see even bigger differences here. But look at this. This is for the group that's not hormone receptor positive. And HER2 negative, and you see this huge response, and it's actually even more striking here. You'll see this again in Barbara's presentation, but there's a 45% absolute difference in people who respond versus not. It's hard to get a better marker than that, I think. So the imaging results, it turns out that MR volume actually is by far the best of the measures to tell you whether or not your tumor is responding, and actually MR volume is a dynamic measure because it incorporates both the percent enhancement, how much uptake you get of contrast and at what time period, and in order to be counted as the pixels. And I think there's actually further work that we can do because we started this, we didn't really understand how critical it was to look at all your results within subsets. So now what we're doing is going back to optimize all of the parameters for what determines volume measurement by subset, and that I think will improve the model completely. So now I'm going to talk to you about I-SPY 2. The whole concept of I-SPY 2 is to screen phase 2 agents in combination with standard chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. Obviously, what I showed you was data on response to standard chemotherapy. So for those people, you don't want to deny people standard chemotherapy at this point until we're sure we know who's going to respond and who's not going to respond. But clearly, not everybody gets that great response, and we want to figure out how we can rapidly figure out which of the agents in the pipeline, the hundreds of agents in the pipeline, can we get some of the most promising ones in and learn early which ones are going to really work. Our endpoint is pathologic complete response. Our threshold is an 85% predicted likelihood of success in a 300-patient phase 3 trial with a biomarker pair. And we have it set up so you can get an IDE for the next trial, and that can be moved forward into the clinic. The whole idea is to accelerate the process of identifying drugs by subtype and to reduce the cost and time of the number of patients needed to get these drugs to market. We used what we could from iSpy 1, our standards for data collection, tissue acquisition, biomarker assays, and imaging acquisition, plus adding all the new things that have come along since, which are rapidly coming along, and kept our culture of sharing data credit. And I think one of the important things is that the database grows as investigators join. So if you apply, you have an assay, you have something you want to look at, the data's already in there, you can use it, but whatever your marker is, you then have to put it back into the database so everyone can see it. And the whole richness of the database grows, and you can look at associations between known biomarkers. The whole concept is that patients come in, they get screened, they get an MRI, biopsy, blood draw, and staging workup, and they only get randomized if they have a 70-gene profile that's high, and so we exclude those patients who are hormone receptor positive and mammoprint low. And again, patients are given either paclitaxel or paclitaxel with one of up to five investigational agents, three drugs in the trial. Now that our accrual rate is up to what we expect, we can start to expand up to the five. And then following that, people get AC, because AC is also standard and probably one of the most sensitive chemo agents. So any HER2 positive patients will also receive trastuzumab or Herceptin unless there is evidence that the drug is as good as or better than Herceptin. And just a note about the biomarkers, we have three levels of biomarkers in the trial. We have established and approved biomarkers, and these have to be FDA cleared or approved. The FDA was at the table when we put this trial together, so their requirement was if you're going to use something for randomization, you either have to have FDA approval or an IDE. So one example of this is we wanted to be able to put people in the HER2 arm if they were HER2 positive by our standard IHC assays, FISH, or now HER2 positive overexpression by array. So on the platform that we're using, we actually had the company get an IDE for HER2 overexpression so that we could then assign those patients to a HER2 targeted arm. Now, the qualifying biomarkers are those biomarkers that we think are going to help us tell which drugs are going to work, for which patients these drugs will work, but it hasn't been proven. And these are all performed in a CLIA laboratory so that when the trial finishes, when the drug graduates, if we in fact have proved that, that drug can go on and be the established biomarker for the next trial. So these, in fact, are hypothesis testing. And I'll give you a couple of examples of some of these. But we work with every company to try and, if they already have markers that they have that they think working, we'll just put them in. We'll put them onto our platforms. We have expression array platforms. We have DNA array platforms. We have protein, phosphoprotein profiles. So the whole way, the more efficient we can be in getting the markers in, the better. But if there are particular serum levels that people want to test, we'll add those in. Now, the exploratory biomarkers are for the discovery of new response predictors, but also for us to think about the platforms that are emerging. If RNA-seq is going to be the platform of the future, can it replace the Agilent and AFI arrays? We don't know. We have to test it. But if those are, we're trying to pick, people like Joe Gray, Laura Vanfier, thinking, surveying the scene, what are the emerging platforms that we should be using? Because we don't want our trial results to be out of date in 10 years or 5 years. We want to be able to have a Rosetta Stone to be able to say, well, okay, these were the old ones, but the new ones can be used, so that'll, we hope, extend the life of, the biologic life of this, of all this data. So these, of course, are hypothesis generating. So as we said in the eligibility, the patients do not go on to randomization. So that's our first tailoring in the trial, is that we really are trying to figure out how to move these patients, only move the patients that are most appropriate forward, where we think that they'll benefit both from chemotherapy and the possibility of a novel agent. Joe Gray actually has set up a panel of 60 cell lines that are completely characterized in terms of phosphoproteins and RNA arrays and DNA arrays, and trying to figure out, is there a gene sequence that really predicts the success? And he has a number of these that we've established. And so every drug going in the trial gets run through the cell line and generates a panel of markers that we're putting on a panomics platform that would be a single slide, a very simple test to look at, and those will be tested in the trial. We're not randomizing on the basis of it, but when the drug graduates, all the qualifying biomarkers can be evaluated along with it. MR, so this is, again, pretreatment showing a complete response, partial response, and progressive disease. The MR actually allows us to also tailor patients. All the information from the MR is very important, particularly because it actually gives us that interim signal and gives us the more definitive idea of what is actually happening in that taxol portion of the trial. Again, PathCR is our final endpoint, but that is but the MR information is important. And over time, we hope that we'll be able to optimize this in a way that we can move on and bring in agents for patients who are not responding. What's important about the MR is that the I-SPY 1 really served to turn MR imaging into a biomarker. You know, I think that people may not understand the complexity of imaging, but everyone often does whatever they want. Everyone has their favorite sequence, but then your data is not comparable. So we learned actually in I-SPY 1 that even the centers that said that they would agree did not, and the people who are usually the most experienced and the best at it did not follow the protocol. So we actually have learned that you have to qualify and show that you can do it, and in I-SPY 2 and also in our I-SPY 1 extension, we actually send someone out. You have to qualify and really get people to make sure that they're using the right protocol. And one of the ways we do that is by giving everybody at Aegis Workstation that Sentinel has developed and actually has turned, again, made the delivery of a volume marker routine and quantitative off the workstation. So the whole idea is that you might have someone come along, you'd see how they do. That information goes back and informs after about 10 patients on a particular drug, after once the trial learns we have. And again, there's a 4-to-5 randomization, so 80% of the patients will get a novel agent, and because everybody shares the same standard therapy arm. And then the trial starts to learn. While we cannot yet adapt within patients, the trial learns and starts to adapt and then start assigning patients with particular biomarker profiles the kinds of drugs that seem to work for those patients. And so, for example, you may drop one drug, seamlessly drop in another. You may graduate a drug and seamlessly drop in another. And so part of the design was to make sure the trial would never go down regardless of drugs coming in and out. We have a process that we get the IRBs to help us develop, actually get everyone to, we actually got all the IRBs to work with us on this protocol. I can talk about that a little bit. So the idea, of course, is the adaptive design. If the drug works better or worse than you think, you'll learn that as the trial progresses. You know, if you have a mutation that's actually putting people at risk, you're not going to find that at the end of the trial. You'll find out during the trial. You'll know right away. So you can stop a drug if you think it's causing a problem, and graduate sooner if you think they're clearly beneficial. And again, the whole idea is to start as undifferentiated as you can and let the trial learn, because that gives, you know, the drug manufacturer the power to say that this is really a targeted agent, and hopefully that follow-on trials can be much smaller and accurate. The graduation is based on effectiveness and prevalence, and of course there were many, many signatures that we could have come up with, but we settled on 10 marketable signatures. We took the 70-gene profile that we're using as the backbone, and we have actually the 44K array data is all coming back to us for exploratory and qualification biomarker purposes. But we split that in half and then looked by hormone receptor and HER2, and these are the various prevalences in the trial, and we can actually look at a drug for the whole group. We can just say we're going to look at it for the hormone receptor positive group or the hormone receptor negative group or for all the HER2s or the HER2 negatives. We can just look at the most aggressive or the worst prognosis patients. We can look at the triple negatives if we want. We can look at the HER2 positive hormone receptor negatives and vice versa, and the hormone receptor positive HER2 negative arms. So in trying to qualify agents for I-SPY 2, we want to test pathways that we think are promising, looking at, and this gives us also the opportunity to review drug development pipelines and target agents and combinations of agents. It's very clear from the FDA that they want to entertain combinations. You heard this morning about how exciting some of these combinations are, so our trial allows us to move combinations forward, and we actually hope to have the Intellikine compound in the I-SPY trial within the next 6 months, actually, and I'm thinking about the combinations. So the whole idea for selection criteria, we want to look at, you have to have phase one testing in combination with Taxol, so you can't have unacceptable toxicity for HER2-directed agents. You either have to have safety data in combination with Herceptin or proof that you don't need Herceptin because your drug is just as good. There has to be efficacy or rationale in breast cancer, but you do not have to have your safety data in breast cancer. We don't care because the phase one is just about safety. And our key pathways are the same pathways that everybody is interested in, of course. And, of course, the company themselves has to be willing to support the trial by giving us their drug. So safety is sort of the key. But we also want to work with companies that we think have exciting compounds to say how can we, so when we are working to get a drug in, we start working with them 3 to 6 months before the drug comes in, trying to think about the biomarkers. And we're also trying to encourage people to set up phase one trials in combination with Taxol with that backbone, because we have many sites across our 20 I-SPY sites that can do the phase one testing. So that, of course, is part of our organizational efficiency. But the whole idea of having a master IND allows us to eliminate the need for a new protocol every time an agent is added. It enables approval as soon as a tier one agent is ready. So when we get all the data ready, we work on the protocol, the amendment, we talk to the FDA, we get it through, we get it listed, we get it so it's on the launching pad in all the IRBs, and the minute a drug goes out and we're ready to put another one, we just seem it requires a signature, so the trial never goes down. And the idea here is to give pharmaceutical companies a pathway for rapid development to figure out early if they've got a signal. And this also is a win for the FDA because they have an opportunity to test a more efficient process for drug qualification. And the foundation for the NIH serves as the honest broker and holds the INDs. We also have an informatics infrastructure that we built to be able to do this because there's a critical need for real-time data. So we worked with a company called Tolvin that has an electronic CHR and where we could have everything coded. And we can actually use we have clinical wizards, so you can enter the clinical data and it automatically populates the case report forms, and they automatically then, the information then is automatically sent to the randomization service once the data is verified. We have 24 hours to verify the data. So that means all the data is verified up front. None of this 2 years to clean up your data. You know, if you're missing a data value, I mean, you would be surprised how many ERPR and HER2 values were missing from top-tier cancer centers. You would think that would never happen. Or I'm sure all the clinicians know, you'd look back and say, is that possible? Could we possibly have missed that? And it's not because people aren't good. It's because you don't have the systems in place to make sure that you don't. I mean, that's why pilots have have checklists. So then all the information is seamlessly integrated into CA tissue, so it generates all the biomarker data. You can imagine how complicated it is, because every specimen is sort of turned into 10 to 20 different kind of biomarkers, and you want to make sure that the numbers don't miss. I was always worried about a mismatch repair in the database. and having something go wrong there, remarkably, that didn't happen. But so we've learned a lot to try and make that better. And then the data then automatically goes right into CA Integrator, so everyone can have access to all the data when the drug graduates. And the whole idea is to have a reusable infrastructure. It's all the tools are open source, and it's supposed to be an adaptive design bundle. So if this works, this could then be adapted and used for other diseases. And I think probably I would attribute the success of this model to the team approach. And really, everything along the way, getting the key stakeholders at the table from the inception. We sat down with the NCI, the FDA, the FNI Biomarkers Consortium, our academic and clinical partners, pharma, biotech, IT, and the advocates. So we had people at the table. Not too many, but just enough. You have to involve new stakeholders as the trial proceeds. The way we got the trial through the IRBs is we had a meeting. At the time, we had 8 sites signed up. We asked all their IRB chairs and the regulatory people to come to a meeting, plus the investigators. And we spent all day looking at the protocol. And everyone had a lot of suggestions. And I filled up the board. I said, if you want to add anything else, I have to take something off. I will. This is the amount of work that we will do. So let's prioritize and get the things that you want changed. And that people had a lot of interesting and good things to say, and the idea was given to me by our IRB chair, John Heldens, and Alan Vinnick, and it was really a great process. And I will tell you that no one has had a problem getting this through their IRB. I can't tell you how much trouble I had getting I-SPY 1 through the IRB, and it didn't even have a novel agent in it. But and it took 2 years to change the protocol to put a new imaging technique in to do MR spec, and still couldn't get it through. So I learned my lesson, and this worked beautifully. So, and again, we have stakeholders from all sites, so every agent and every biomarker has chaperones, so there's plenty of work to do in this trial, and people have the responsibility for serving as the monitors for the toxicity for these agents. And we also have a DSMB that meets monthly that goes through all of this, so this is our way of being safe. Our advocates are also partners. They've done a great job. They reviewed the protocol, worked very much on the informed consent, helped us put training materials together. When issues come up, they really help us. They help us disseminate information to the public. And these are our sites, as you can see. San Diego. And so these are the sites so far that are open and rolling. We've just finished the initiation of University of Arizona and University of Kansas, and MD Anderson is opening next month. This is what's happened so far. The trial has been open not quite a year. UCSF was the first to open, but we were the only ones open for about 4 months or 5 months. And so we have 113 patients that have been enrolled to date. And these are the patients that got excluded. We actually thought we were anticipating about a 20% exclusion on the basis of being a hormone receptor positive and mammaprint low. And initially it was high, but now it's settled down to about 20%. So that's about what it is. And you can see we're starting to get patients now through the pipeline. We actually accrued 33 patients in the last 6 weeks, which puts us on target for about 240 patients a year, so about 200 patients registered, which is maybe even a little higher than we had anticipated. So and that's in less than a year, so we're pretty excited about that. Here is just the enrollment by site. I just wanted to show you what a great job UCSD has done, and they have been open only half as long as we have. So anyway, very, very exciting, and we also do this expected. So this is the kind of work that we do, and we do. We look at everything we do. We look for quality improvement. We look at our expected versus observed, and we are actually having meetings with every site that's not accruing on time. David Diltz has a paper that says if you don't have your accrual goals in the first few months, you're never going to accrue, and our oversight committee has told us that if people are not up to snuff, after a year they have to be, they have to get out of the trial because we don't have the resources to have people who don't accrue. And I would say that this has been just an enormous team effort. I'm just lucky to lead a group of passionate people that really care about it, and I would say that everyone has contributed in so many ways, and Barbara Parker is one of our drug chaperones, and is also working with us now on, we're already starting to anticipate how we might improve it we're breaking an I Spy 3 and things like that. So in summary, I would say that I Spy 2 is an experiment in itself. It's an experiment to try and figure out whether we can accelerate drug development and biomarker qualification and streamline the clinical trial process and broaden the opportunity to test agents more quickly, to learn early, which drugs are going to be the big winners. We're not looking for incremental benefit. So, you know, if it doesn't work in I-SPY 2 doesn't mean the drug won't work for anything. It just means you didn't have a big benefit. That's what we're looking for. And we want to find out, and this is really for a group of proliferative tumors with high risk for early metastasis and death. We want to usher in changes in regulatory science. So we are working with the FDA to try and help make sure that they understand how to use this data. We have a meeting in May where we're trying to understand what are the ways in which drugs can proceed if they do get a big signal from this trial. And we really want to increase pre-competitive collaboration. We think that that's going to be a big win for the industry and especially for our patients and for our scientists. And we hope that this will inspire the development of next generation trials. This is not the only way, but we hope this is just the beginning of people thinking more creatively about this space. And I think that there are kind of five critical things that people need to think about. Some kind of neoadjuvant setting where you have the built-in opportunity for biomarkers, that you have molecular imaging biomarker guidance, that you can test multiple drugs at the same time in an efficient way, sharing one common standard, common platform for sharing data, and using adaptive design. So we hope that what we will see is a change in the drug development paradigm, you know, where we are getting five FDA drugs approved start to finish, five times more product for a fifth the cost. So maybe anywhere from 50 to 100-fold improvement is the kind of thing that you could get if this model works. That'll stay questions.